From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with painter Jamie Wyeth. An established artist in his own right, Jamie Wyeth is also the son of one of America's best-known painters, Andrew Wyeth. Also today, horror fiction writer Clive Barker talks about blood and guts and overflowing toilets. Rock and roll critic Ken Tucker reviews Don't Let Me Down, David Bowie's latest album. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at Ishtar, the new comedy starring Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me on Fresh Air is painter Jamie Wyeth. He's the third generation of his family to achieve prominence for a representational style of painting. His grandfather, N.C. Wyeth, was an illustrator of adventure books like Treasure Island. His father, Andrew, is perhaps America's most popular realist painter, best known for his stark portrayals of American rural life. Like his father and grandfather, Jamie Wyeth is a keen observer of rural surroundings. Some of his most famous paintings are unsentimentalized portrayals of animals. He's also widely known for portraits of his contemporaries like Rudolf Nureyev and Andy Warhol, and for his posthumous portrait of John F. Kennedy. The Wyeth family has been in the news on two fronts recently. Last summer, Andrew revealed 240 intimate paintings of a woman named Helga, paintings that he had kept secret from everyone, including his family. And an exhibition of paintings of the three Wyeths' work just opened in Moscow. Jamie Wyeth has just returned from Russia, where he was on hand for the opening. The show will open in America on July 4th at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Then it tours America for 2 years and finally heads off to Europe to tour there. Jamie Wyeth, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Well, you just returned from the family group show in the Soviet Union, and I wonder if your work in the Soviet Union took on any social or political overtones that it doesn't have in America. I guess I'm thinking in part because it's a realist painting and because the Soviets have tended to favor realism over abstraction.
Well, I was more amazed how knowledgeable they were of our work. I mean, that rather fascinated me, and they had a real knowledge and seemed to be know certain paintings and so forth. But I don't think... clearly the Soviets, they think, I mean, representational painters that maybe were housebroken and so forth. But I first was reluctant thinking that this was some sort of political game, that I was sort of a puppet. And it turned out not to be the case. They generally, you know, before the show opened, let's say in Leningrad, they'd all say, oh, we love your work, the Wyeths and so forth. And then once they saw the work, I mean, I can tell when people are insincere. And they were quite moved by some of the things. So the political thing sort of disappeared happily.
Did you get any different interpretations from Soviet viewers than you're used to getting from American viewers?
Yeah, a bit. I was, my father and I were rather amazed. He did not go, of course, but we thought my grandfather's work would be the most interest. It seems that the Soviets are more interested in contemporary. I mean, they want what's now. I mean, his illustrations, yes, they liked and so forth, but they wanted to see contemporary depictions. They're quite timely about things. I mean, my portrait of Andy Warhol, he had just died shortly before that, and so that got big crowds and technique. But, their point of view was rather fascinating. Of course, it's difficult. Speaking of so few that I spoke to really spoke English, so that was hard.
And it's hard to go through a translator and
very
really
difficult.
Speak person to person.
Particularly speaking in sort of abstracts as you do in painting and whatnot. I mean, any continuity in conversation was difficult and tiring, finally. It's sort of...
One of your most famous portraits is of Rudolf Nureyev. Is it true that was censored from the show?
Yes, they when the exhibition was being thought of and so forth at the State Department, they knocked that. Actually, it was rather amusing. One of the Soviet delegation said, well, perhaps we include it if we say he's an unknown dancer from the Ukraine. but it definitely was taken out of the thing.
Painter Jamie Wyeth is my guest. Let's talk about your background as a painter. You started painting when you were very young, and I'm wondering if you think that was a lucky break in a way, that you started when you were too young to realize both the burdens and the opportunities of being a third-generation American realist mm-hmm. painter.
Well, I don't know if it's a lucky break, but I mean, I think it was just natural to me. I wanted to leave school purely because I just wanted to paint. It was a question that I'd bouncing a rubber ball across some floor did not interest me, and painting did. So I saw it as a, to leave school and be tutored, which just gave me more time to work and so forth. I then, you know, I have some people say, well, you missed a, you know, a great thing by not going to college or not playing football. And maybe some morning I'll jump out of bed and say, God, why didn't I play football? But, I mean, I don't think, you know, I mean, I don't think I really lost much in that. And I think the fact of beginning early, and it's probably the only discipline you really can do then. I mean, in painting, I mean, what is it? It's a stick with some hair on the end of it and a piece of cloth and paint. You don't need college. I mean, you don't need so many of the other things that one would need if they're a writer and so forth. So I think it's to an advantage to get the hell out of school and start painting as soon as possible.
Your parents agreed to your suggestion, as I think it was when you were in sixth grade, mm-hmm. they agreed to your suggestion that you drop out of school and take home tutoring?
No, it was a great fight between my mother and father. My mother was against it, my father was for it. There had been somewhat of a precedent. He had left school due to an illness when he was younger. And so it was quite a big fight. And then the Pennsylvania Board of Education did not want me leaving school. So that was another sort of battle. And I had to prove to them every month I'd have to go back to be retested and so forth. And if my marks had slipped a certain degree, I then would be plucked back into public school. It so happened school was not that difficult to me. And so I was able to paint and do my courses in the morning.
How much did your father participate in the teaching process?
In one sense, a lot, but in a visible sense, not very much at all. I mean, his presence was the great teacher. I mean, the fact that, you know, we painted in the same house. I mean, he lived, his studio was where we lived. As far as actual teaching, again, painting, I think, is perhaps the only discipline where you really cannot instruct somebody to paint. I mean, I think if anything in art school is valuable in the sense that takes somebody with a certain talent and instills them in the work ethic, I mean, makes them paint. Other than that, you certainly can't say, well, that's the wrong color or this is the wrong line and so forth. I mean, everybody has their vocabulary and their point of view. He was terrific in the sense that, and he was aware of that, obviously, and he would say, I mean, if, let's say, an ear was drawn badly, he'd say, look at the form of something, Jamie. And he wouldn't say specifically, you know, that ear is wrong or something, you know. So in fact, it's the best form of teaching, really.
You know, a lot of people hate to be taught by members of their family. I think driving is the best example. It's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why you're maybe really better off going to a driving school, because family neuroses really tend to come out, I think, when one member of the family is teaching somebody else how to mm-hmm. do something.
Well, painting is a neurotic endeavor, so those neuroses sort of enhance it, I think.
Now, didn't you study anatomy by going to a morgue?
Yeah, I went. I felt a need purely, it was curiosity on my part, to. I was interested in the human body and the figure and how it worked, and the only way to do that was to dissect it, and so I found a hospital that was willing to let me come in and do that. So I did that for a year.
What did you want to look at during the dissection process?
It was just purely curiosity on my part. I mean, in an art school, you can observe a dissection. Well, that, you know, what usually happens is they go to a medical school and they observe the dissection of the stomach, which, of course, is of no help to a painter. But to actually touch the things, I mean, today when I paint somebody's face, I mean, a curve of a cheek, I know what's under there. And I think as in any field, anything one does, the more you know about it, the more interesting it is to you. I mean, the more fascinating it becomes. Why is that dimple there? Why is this? And I went and dissected and felt those things, and I'll never forget it. The terms, the Latin names I've forgotten, but the anatomist that taught me was a wonderful Russian who sensed that and knew it and said, you know, Jamie, do not worry about, you know, what these things were called. Just you figure out how they operate. And it was wonderful.
Did you have to overcome physical revulsion?
Well, I did, because I was curious about it. I mean, that overcame that. He warned me about bringing friends down and whatnot, which I did not do. He said, because he rightly said, you have a reason to be here. If you did not, then you'd be appalled by it.
A what?
You'd
appalled
be appalled by it.
Oh, and a voyeur also. It would be kind of strange. You were probably one of the few realists who didn't start off as an abstractionist. I've interviewed a lot of realist painters who told me about how in school they really felt rebellious because they were taught by their teachers how to mm-hmm. do abstract painting, and they violated all the rules by becoming a realist. You didn't.
That's kind of interesting.
Well, that's how
yeah.
it was for them. Yeah, yeah. Now, you didn't go through that.
Well, I went through. I do it every time I paint. I mean, my painting starts as a very abstract form. I mean, a lot of paint is thrown around the studio. A lot ends up in me and on the floor. I think people would be shocked if they saw how things they think are rather, you know, nicely done or well done and so forth. Helping. So, I mean, in a curious sense, it goes through that method every time I work. Starts as an abstract shape, form, something that nobody would recognize.
Why does it keep becoming representational?
Well, because what interests me is the object, the face. I mean, for me to start abstracting the physiognomy of something just doesn't interest me. I mean, if I'm attracted to a pig or a politician, I want to paint their nose and their eyeballs. I don't want to sort of abstract that form. I mean, I think there's a great interest today in the creator, the painter and whatnot, is infinitely more interesting in his work. Well, I find that's untrue. And I just personally feel that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. And so therefore, if I'm attracted to this particular dancer and whatnot, well, why abstract the shape of him and the form of him, you know? And then I have a certain insolence or whatever where I feel that I'm doing the definitive portrait of this pig. And I think with the advent of photography and the history of painting, that sort of went out the window, the need to record. I, however, still have the desire to record things.
Painter Jamie Wyeth is my guest. Did you ever go through a period of soul-searching, thinking, oh, but in order to be contemporary and relevant, I'd better get with it and abandon realism?
I did. You know, outside my studio, those considerations would rise and whatnot. But, I mean, I find painting so difficult that those sort of things remain outside the door of my studio. I mean, what I'm working on is, I mean, all my energies go into that and so forth. So all those things become secondary. And again, I mean, those are perceptions that the audience brings, whatever they want to feel or, you know. I myself am more concerned about what I'm working on right now.
You've done some really interesting portraits of animals. It's hard enough to get a person to pose for you. How do you do a portrait of an animal? You can't ask it to stay still for you.
Well, posing for me is not sitting rock solid and staring at a spot in the wall. It's being with the person, the animal, over a long period of time. It's sort of living with them, breathing, becoming them, and so forth. And yes, they're problems. I mean, right now I have a ram that I'm painting, and he'll go up the steps to my studio, but he won't go down the steps, so I have to carry him down every day. But those are small problems compared to the actual painting.
Another thing I really like about your portraits of animals, they're not sentimental. They're not sentimental.
Well, I hope not. And animals are not sentimental creatures. I mean, this notion of pigs being sweet little Miss Piggies and whatnot is far from the truth. Pigs are very nasty, moody. I mean, it can be loving too, but I mean, they have their snits and their moods and their likes and dislikes. And I hope that comes through in the work. I don't want some cutie pie, you know, sort of country barnyard sort of scene. And, you know, I've always, I mean, and I, the fact that I choose these things is purely an accident of where I was born. I mean, had I been born in Philadelphia, I'd be painting the streets of Philadelphia. I'd be painting the taxi cabs. It just happens that I was born in the country. That's the vocabulary I know best, and there you are.
You were born in Chatsford, Pennsylvania, which is a region that was already made famous in a way through your father's paintings. I wonder if it was hard for you to find your own subject matter because the area that you lived in had already been so well painted by your father.
That really was not such a problem because if you look at my work, there are not many landscapes per se and whatnot. The things I've worked on are things that I've known and grown up with and interest me. I mean, nothing interests me less than, I mean, people come to me and say, oh, I saw this wonderful tree yesterday, Jamie. You loved a tree paint or this wonderful face on this man. Well, nothing interests me less than interesting looking trees or faces of interest. What does interest me are trees that I've known and grown up with, noses and eyeballs that I've known and grown up with or have some connection to and so forth. So there never was a thing of, you know, uh-oh, am I stepping on Andrew Wyeth's subjects or is he stealing that one from me? There never was that sort of sense.
So there was no problem in finding your own voice?
No, and I think, gosh, one can live. I live on an island in Maine, Monhegan Island, which is a mile long and half a mile wide, and people say, well, gee, you must be running out of subjects. Well, I mean, I could live there three lifetimes and still not even scratch the surface of the island, you know.
There's a recent portrait I'd like to talk with you about. It's called Kaluna. And I wanted you to describe the portrait. Who
Kaluna in Frogtown, actually, is what it's called. It's a boy. It's a family, a Laotian family that I've brought over, and they live with us and live on the farm. And the young boy I asked to pose last year, and he agreed. This is a remarkable young boy. I mean, he came here. He was old enough when he left Laos to know the world and so forth of where he, from what he came, and the change, I mean, to match, it just astounded me, the hero boy. And now he's second in the state in terms of mathematics and whatnot. I mean, brilliant little kid. And the whole juxtaposition of this alien being brought to here, and then he walks around with sort of Dallas T-shirts and American flags, and he loves trucks and whatnot. And yet he carries so much of the culture of his country still. I mean, he's still, his powers of concentration are fascinating. I mean, I've painted kids, American kids, and usually their attention span is about 10 seconds. This boy, I mean, he studied my palette. He'd watch me work and whatnot. It's interesting. They're different.
Painter Jamie Wyeth is my guest. Jamie, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back more and talk about your work. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is painter Jamie Wyeth. He, by the way, just returned from the Soviet Union. There's a show on exhibit there of the three generations of Wyeth's work. And that show is Moving to America. It opens at the Corcoran Gallery of Art on July 4th and then tours America for 2 years before heading off to Europe for another tour. Did you ever get off the track? Here's what I'm thinking. You knew you wanted to paint when you were really young, a time before most of us have any idea of what we really want to be when we're an adult, and you stuck with it. Was there ever a time where you questioned that and went crazy for a little bit?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's times when I got up and wanted to be a flyer or wanted to be this and that as any child. But again, I'm really sort of an uninteresting person because all that interests me is painting. And the problems that I run into while I paint and what I encounter makes everything else sort of immaterial. I mean, I don't know, it's an addictive sort of thing. I mean, painting, I always say, is sort of an opiate to me, and it is. I mean, it's what I want to do. And so I never, as a child, even when I was painting constantly, I never had real sort of second doubts. I never had the pressure people felt. Well, you were in a family of painters. Obviously, they said, you better paint. I have a brother who certainly drank the same milk, ate the same food. He has no interest in painting. Sells paintings, but doesn't paint. So it never was a sort of a thing where I decided, gosh, I have this thing on my shoulders. I want to, get out from under this. Because those considerations, as I say, stay outside the door of the studio. I mean, the things I deal with when I work are much more important to me than those sort of baggage that people bring.
Was there a period, I guess I'm thinking of maybe the time when you started painting Nureyev and Warhol, where you were hanging out more in Manhattan as opposed to the rural setting that you grew up in, and just really getting into a more urban life and a more fast-paced life, a more social life than you were used to?
Well, yes, there was that, but there was a reason to do it. I mean, I wanted to become Warhol's life. I mean, we went everywhere together. I tried to approach it like a sponge and just sort of absorb everything. With Nureyev, the same sort of thing. His discipline as a dancer. I mean, I became a total sort of dancer. I mean, I went to every sort of performance, every rehearsal and so forth. But there was a reason for it. And then when I finished the painting of either Andy or Nureyev, I mean, I had squeezed myself finally. I mean, that was it. I mean, I was just drained emotionally and physically and so forth. So then I came back. So it wasn't a question that all of a sudden I saw, I tasted wine and water, then lost its sort of appeal to me. I mean, it's still the wine was still ticking.
Why is it that important to you to really help live somebody's life with them before you paint their portrait?
Because I want to get away. The dangers of being a representational painter is that you just are interested in the physiognomy of something, that you're just on the surface. Then people say, well, why not a photograph? And I agree, why not a photograph? I think if you dig deeper, I mean, with Nureyev, I wanted to see him do every move. I wanted to see how he slept, how he ate, and so on. I mean, that goes into the painting, I feel. Whether it's osmosis or something, it's still, and out of it, I think, comes something hopefully with a little more impact than just sitting down, taking a photograph of somebody, copying the lines, copying the mouth, and so forth. I mean, And I think that's where representational painting can have a similarity to abstract painting. I think a representational painting should be exciting if it's turned upside down. It shouldn't rely on, gee, look, that grass looks real, or those look like real bricks. It should be fascinating in just its forms and shapes. And that's what we can learn. That's why, I mean, a lot of the paintings that I'm interested in are abstract paintings.
There are so many children of successful parents who really flounder all of their lives and who feel that they have to measure up to this thing and can't and
yeah.
lose
Yeah, I never had that problem. I don't quite know why. But I have friends, Peter Serkin and Rudolf Serkin, his father. I mean, there are some that have had great problems. I say that painting was all my time was consumed, my mind with that. I mean, any of those consequences were small compared to what I was dealing with, trying to sort of get across what I felt and what I needed.
Does the subject matter that interests you change as you get older?
I'm of course it does. But again, I'm very careful to not start analyzing why I'm doing something. I feel if I do that, I start freezing and what direction am I moving? I mean, I'll let other people tell me that. I just know by past experience that's not a thing that I want to spend time doing.
You like to be very close to someone who you're painting, yet you were commissioned to do a posthumous portrait of John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
How did you compensate for the fact that you couldn't even see him?
Right. Well, by both the brothers, his brothers at that time, Bobby and Teddy, let me follow them around. I bird-dogged them everywhere. And actually, there's a portrait of Edward Kennedy under that portrait. I created a memory of him. I mean, this is something I'll never attempt again.
A posthumous
portrait. Then I spent about 2 weeks at the National Archives looking at 4 hours of film today, of family films, pictures that she had taken of the president and so forth. And the reason for that is I tried to establish a memory of him. Maybe had I met him for 15 minutes and whatnot, which I didn't have. That, however, that painting still to this day, I'm very on shaky ground with the painting. I mean, when people say, well, that looks nothing like President Kennedy, well, you know, they're probably right. Maybe it doesn't. But I think there were enough people that knew him really well said that it had a sense of him.
Probably a lot of people approach you, want to commission you to do a painting of them or someone in their family. Do you do that?
I don't. Because, it's impossible unless you really know the person well. I mean, again, you just end up with noses and eyeballs and ears and whatnot.
And I guess I have to really interest you also.
Yes. I mean, you have to know a lot more about them to get, at least for me. Now, maybe when I get older, I'll be mature enough to sort of pop into a room and whip off a portrait of somebody. But at this point, I feel very unstable attempting it.
Painter Jamie Wyeth is my guest. I have to ask you about the Helga paintings, which came to light last summer. And your father had, for 15 years, painted a series of portraits, many of them nudes, of a woman named Helga. And he apparently kept it a secret from everyone, including your family. And last year he told the family and told the press. And it was a really big story. How did you find out about it? Who'd you hear it from?
I'd sort of known a lot about it as it went along.
Nobody knew. No,
it's just my mother didn't know.
Not
many. Well, my father and I have a curious relationship in that we are, I mean, the whole father and son thing sort of goes out the window, and which is wonderful. I mean, I think he's my most honest critic, and I hope I am of his, because we have no portion to bear, nothing to bring to it. I mean, I don't have baggage to say, well, does he like, you know, this and that. So we're able to, to sort of see the work of one another and be fairly honest about it, which is a wonderful, wonderful experience.
So you were probably told not to let your mother know about the paintings?
Well, I mean, he doesn't tell people who I'm working with. I mean, this is just a given, you know. I mean, not purely because we don't want to, we want a secret that, oh my gosh, a wife will be upset. That's not the case at all. It's just there's something that violates something with you. When you're working on something, I hate talking about what I'm working on because it takes a certain energy of it away. I mean, I don't know, if somebody comes into my studio and sees something that's half finished, I mean, either they say, oh, that's wonderful, don't touch it. Then you, of course, freeze and say, oh, my God, I've caught something I want to. Or they say, that's terrible and whatnot. Well, then, of course, you're depressed. So it's better to just keep that whole thing to yourself. And I think with this series, which is an obsessive sort of series of paintings, which finally will be seen, and I've seen in their true light rather than all the sensationalism, it's a remarkable effort by one person. I mean, it looks like a different woman in all the paintings. I mean, he used her as sort of a springboard for lots of experiments and things.
Of course, a question that everybody wanted to know was she his mistress? You know, did they have a sexual relationship?
I don't think so. I think they were just terribly, I mean, he was able to manipulate and use her as a model. I mean, she's a remarkable woman. And she's totally, as you know, I hate, and he also hates being in a room with somebody when you're working. I mean, that's the problem of doing a portrait of a person. She's such that he was able to sort of mold her in whatever he wished, you know, and she was a fascinating woman who, you know, remained sort of anonymous.
What was your mother's reaction when he told her?
Well, I think her first reaction was, I mean, when she first saw their extraordinary group of paintings, I mean, it'll knock anybody out. I mean, they really are phenomenal. Then, of course, it set in the fact, I mean, Betsy White is a woman who likes to know what's going on and so forth. So that did sort of shake her. And I think as a consequence, that's why the paintings were sold. My father said, just get them out of the house, you know, and which he did, lock, stock, and barrel.
Why didn't he tell her? I mean, he didn't keep other secrets, other paintings a secret from her.
Well, oh, yes. I mean, she knows nothing of what he's working on at the time. This was not a precedent. I mean, he's a very mysterious person. I mean, he doesn't like anybody knowing where he's going, what tree he's going to, and so forth. I mean, this is nothing new to my father. So it follows right along. It just happens to be a woman this time. And yes, 15 years of work is sort of obsessive. I think the extraordinary thing is at the same time, he did a whole other body of work. So, I mean, really, nobody was really aware that this was going on. And I love the whole notion that here could be somebody doing a series of paintings. At that time, he said they'd never be seen until he died. And, I mean, that to me is the ultimate test of the interest in your own work, you know, what you're doing. I mean, here he was doing something with no other audience to see it and never would the rest of his life have seen it. I think he then got to a point, I mean, he'd had a rather depressing year of painting, he felt and whatnot, and here were all these crates of these paintings, and so he decided to show them to her.
I have to ask you about something else. I had read somewhere that you and I think other members of your family collect World War II memorabilia, Nazi uniforms, and German cars.
German. I have collected German uniforms, sure.
How come?
I don't know. I just thought that they're sort of fascinating, like the sinister side of them and so forth. The fact that it's a visual sort of sinister thing, and what it represents, which, of course, what it represented was horror, but the fact that it was embodied in a uniform in these forms became rather fascinating to me.
Does it tie in with your painting at all?
I think there's a certain edge to it, a certain horror. I mean, you know, as you mentioned earlier, that these animals are not bucolic animals. I mean, you know, there's this, hopefully there's an underlying sense of sort of dread and whatnot.
One last thing I'd like to know. The art world is very divided about your work and your father's work as well. And on one side, you have the people who commend you as one of the great contemporary American realist painters. On the other side, there's the art critics who say that your work and your father's work derives from illustration and that it's finally not important work. How do you cope with that debate? Do you pay attention at all?
I really don't. Again, that's the sort of thing. I mean, it's going to be an endless debate. It'll continue on. I mean, maybe it's better that there is a debate. That's where, I mean, one of the reasons I'm here in Philadelphia is this Creative Artist Network. And here you have young painters who don't have an audience and whatnot. Galleries won't give them the space and so forth. And this organization is an organization that gives them walls to hang on, gives them some economic support. And, you know, I mean, they're in an enviable position. Unfortunately, we're too talked about.
Jamie Wyeth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been painter Jamie Wyeth, and some of his work is now on display in the Soviet Union in an exhibit with his father and his grandfather, Andrew Wyeth and N.C. Wyeth. That show opens in America on July 4th at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., then tours America for 2 years. This is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with sportscaster and former baseball catcher Tim McCarver, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, horror writer Clive Barker explains why he wants to scare the heck out of us. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews David Bowie's new album, Don't Let Me Down. Film critic Stephen Schiff gives his verdict on Ishtar, the new Dustin Hoffman-Warren Beatty comedy. And we'll get the latest news from NPR in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. And now the news. This is Fresh Air. David Bowie has a new album out. It's called Never Let Me Down. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says Bowie, the rock star chameleon, has changed his color again. Before we hear from Ken, let's listen to the opening of a song from the album. This is Day In, Day Out.
David Bowie has breathlessly confessed to his diary, otherwise known as Rolling Stone magazine, that his new album, Never Let Me Down, quote, includes every style I've ever played in, unquote. Since this album is surprisingly good, surprising because so much of his recent work as both musician and actor has been so mediocre, I thought we could listen to one of his new songs and then have a little chat about this English rocker's changeability. This is the title song from David Bowie's new album, Never Let Me Down.
Jacked in a high dollar joint inside.
That's Never Let Me Down, a good example of Bowie at his most effective, stealing up-to-the-minute rhythm and blues riffs and making them into slinky pop music. That song is pleasant but lightweight, as is Bowie's entire canon. His importance in the history of rock is that his prominence has less to do with his music than with his presence. He's made an art out of image. Never Let Me Down is Bowie's 17th album, unusual enough in the here-today and gone-tomorrow world of pop. Bowie is like the Christmas fruitcake that keeps reappearing every year. He's 40 now, but like his pal Mick Jagger, he likes to jump around in tight leather to convince you that he still feels young. In the early 70s, it was Bowie who made glitter rock a pop phenomenon with his languid cross-dressing and the tart hard rock of his first alter ego, Ziggy Stardust. When disco was all the rage, Bowie assumed the character of the Thin White Duke and actually got a good album out of it, Station to Station, in 1976. Bowie has been resourceful about maintaining his visibility. When his recording career slumped in the early 80s, he pretended to be a movie star in bombs like Just a Gigolo and The Hunger. He even played the Elephant Man on Broadway, although when he took off his shirt, the play became the Chicken Man. Perhaps the most interesting persona Bowie has adopted was the one he was pushing just a few years ago, around the time of his album Let's Dance. He did a slew of interviews proclaiming that he was, oh, the horror, an ordinary guy, a single father, a hard worker. With the release of Never Let Me Down, Bowie is now offering himself as the aging but plucky rock legend, eager to prove he can still attract a crowd. As usual, he's got the media figured out. Rolling Stone just noted with undisguised admiration that the former decadent now lifts weights and works out. David Bowie will commence a U.S. tour in June. Be prepared for this latest persona, the British yuppie with muscles.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is British horror writer Clive Barker. Readers are drawn to and often repulsed by his graphic images, like a severed hand with a life of its own, walking zombies, or a cannibalistic pig with the soul of a boy. Known for his collections of short stories, Barker has now written his first novel. It's called The Damnation Game, and it's set in a hellish version of present-day London. In the novel, Barker writes, "Hell is reimagined by each generation." I asked him how the hell he conjures up is different from what his predecessors created.
My hells, plural, are more visceral, more specific, more visual maybe. I want my readership to enter the hells of my books and smell them, feel them, enjoy them in some perverse kind of way perhaps, but nevertheless enjoy them. And feel, when they've stepped from the book, that they've escaped something which was as real as the world into which they have escaped.
Is your hell more graphic than your predecessors?
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's there in as much detail as I can create.
Well, a lot of people are really very offended at graphic images in horror novels or horror movies.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I feel that there's obviously an audience out there that simply doesn't want to see its horror in Technicolor. It wants the writer to present a world in which just at the moment the beast or the atrocity lurches into view, the shadows deepen and we cut away to another scene. That's not my style of horror. It's an absolutely legitimate approach. And my approach to it is that whatever I'm seeing in my mind's eye, I'm going to put on the page. It seems churlish in the extreme to imagine a monster, imagine a scene, and then say, well, I'm not going to show that to the reader. I can deal with that, but I'm not sure the reader can. I think that's condescending. What I can see in my mind's eye, I will show the reader to the limit. And if that means there are some people out there who say that my books are too strong for them, then that's a pity. That's regrettable. But I don't think I would ever be moved to self-censorship because of that.
You know, the sensation that I felt reading your book wasn't so much fear as it was the sense of nausea and revulsion. There are some incredibly revolting images in the book that I think are terrific.
Flatter me.
No. I mean, I made the mistake of reading some of this shortly after breakfast.
Right. But, did you get your breakfast back?
No. I was okay. But I want to ask you to read a passage that describes one of, I think, the more explicitly revolting scenes. And you know the section I mean.
I do indeed. Our heroine, Karis, is imprisoned in the house of one of the many villains who stalk the pages of the Damnation Game, the last European Mamoulian. And he needs some information from her, and which she seems unwilling to give. And so she's, as it were, bombarded with images and illusions, which are all created or conjured by Mamoulian in order to make her give in. It's a kind of torture by imagination, and this is a scene in which she's locked herself in the toilet in order to avoid him, and he's outside and induces a particularly nauseating fantasy for her. This is how it goes. And then the pipes began to rumble. Somewhere in the system, a tide was moving. The sink made a sucking sound. The water in the toilet bowl splashed. The toilet lid flapped open and slammed closed again as a gust of fetid air was discharged from below. This was his doing somehow, though it seemed a vacuous exercise. The toilet farted again. The smell was noxious. "What's happening?" she asked under her breath. The dribbles from the toilet had become a stream, as if the sewers had backed up and were discharging their contents at her feet. Not simply excrement and water, the soup of hot dirt had bred monsters, creatures that could be found in no sane zoology, beasts that fed on excrement whose bodies were a pun on what they devoured. Everywhere in the silt, forgotten stuff, offal and dregs, raised itself on queasy legs and flapped and paddled towards her.
How did you come up with the idea for this scene?
For this scene, bad plumbing at my house. Actually, the ideas linger around for such a long time, and I make notes of all this stuff, the dreams and the daydreams. And by the time I actually come to sort of put them into some kind of narrative, very often I've forgotten the origins. And that's a case in point. It may very well be. I don't remember being scared of toilets as a child. It may very well be that I was.
There's a scene in which there are several decapitations, and I just want to read a passage from it. It says, "A third prisoner's head rolled in the snow, and a fourth. A soldier laughed. The blood steamed. Its meaty smell was appetizing to a man who hadn't been fed for a week." That is also a very, really nauseating image. And it's especially nauseating, I think, when someone has such an inappropriate reaction to blood as this character has had.
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised at how common that response actually is. I do research on this stuff, and I don't want to go into the details in public about how I know how appetizing the smell of blood can sometimes be, but I did research that and got that... got that response actually personally.
I really want to know how you researched this.
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I did for this research, which I've never done before, I actually went to an autopsy, and which I was very scared and very nervous about, because believe it or not, I'm squeamish, and I thought I'm probably not going to be able to handle this. And it turned out to be an extraordinary experience, which elicited from me a number of responses which would appear to be inappropriate. And I think that, for one thing, I found the whole experience very beautiful, which really surprised me. I expected to be grossed out, and I wasn't. And halfway through this thing, I got very hungry and said, you know, I'm hungry, guys. This took 3 hours. And they said, oh, yeah, it makes you hungry, this business. this was the pathologist and the mortuary assistants. Yeah, very, very appetite-inducing business. And I took that away and I thought, well, yeah, maybe I can use that. And I think that the inappropriate response sometimes makes a scene more true. Because if I had simply said that the character was looking at the heads rolling and said he was sickened, maybe the reader says, well, yeah, that's a man who has not experienced this, assuming that the sight of heads rolling is simply sickening. By picking up a little bit of a detail which seems inappropriate, which seems odd, I think you lend truth or verisimilitude to the scene. Otherwise, you're just left with human beings facing monsters or scenes which terrify them. And that's got to be a limited arena.
On a more superficial level, we do find it very entertaining, in a way, to be revolted or nauseated or scared in the context of fiction or a movie.
Right. Though I'm not sure that that's necessarily a superficial thing. In fact, I think that most of these issues about horror and fear and all, this whole area of dark imaginings is actually very complex and worth more study and more critical attention than, for the most part, it gets.
What scares you now? For instance, like if you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't fall back asleep and things are just coming to haunt you, what are the kinds of things that scare you now?
You know, I don't have nightmares. Maybe because
never?
I truly don't. I used to when I was a kid, but I haven't had nightmares for maybe, I don't know, 20 years.
Are you that well adjusted?
I think, no, good God, you read this stuff, you think I'm well adjusted? No, it's on the page. The scary stuff is made concrete in my imagination. I drag it out of the subconscious, out of my subconscious, and show it to myself before setting it on the page. And that process, I think, is very healthy.
Clive Barker's first novel is called The Damnation Game. He's also written and directed his first movie called Hellraiser. It's expected to be released in August. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
You're continuing to track the Iran-Contra hearings.
Yes, which are today from some people who gave money to Carl Spitz Channel, who was raising money to support the Contras.
And I understand you're going to reveal some new information about telephone theft.
Yeah, we have a story on what it is that the very competitive long-distance telephone companies cooperate on. It is on trying to crack down on people who are stealing service from them. A big telephonic game of cops and robbers, which is really not a game. Also, a review of Beverly Hills Cop 2, Terry.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Look forward to that. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio. Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty are camping it up in Elaine May's new movie, Ishtar. These two movie stars are cast against type, but for many they've been upstaged by the movie's price tag. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The question is this. What would we think of Ishtar if we didn't know that it cost over $50 million to make? And what would we think if we didn't know that its leading players, Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman, were two of the biggest superstars in the universe? And what would we think if we didn't know that Ishtar had been one of the most controversial and eagerly awaited film projects of the decade? What would we think? We'd think, eh. This imitation Bob Hope and Bing Crosby comedy isn't terrible, it's just nothing. It's fatally mild. Ishtar is about two inept singer-songwriters who take a gig somewhere near Morocco and wind up being chased by the CIA, an evil emir, and a host of crazed revolutionaries. In short, you've seen everything in it before. The whole movie is a monument to underachievement. Everybody keeps busy doing something he's not particularly good at. For instance, Dustin Hoffman plays a lady killer, and Warren Beatty plays a klutz who doesn't know what to do with women. This was probably someone's idea of a high concept. But the net result is that Hoffman's character feels unfocused and Beatty's disappears completely. The stars are playing down to their roles, and they've never looked so dim. The writer-director was Elaine May, who's always been good at urban, neurotic Jewish comedy, so naturally she busies herself with long chase scenes through assorted North African bazaars. The only really funny stuff comes when the Beatty and Hoffman characters try to write songs together. That's the only part of the movie that feels spontaneous and uncalculated. Here's a sampler.
Saturday morning, the sound of a lawnmower touches my heart. She said, come look, there's a... She said, come look, there's a wardrobe of love in my eyes. Take your time, look around, and see if there's something your size.
There are people who feel that Ishtar is another example of the Heaven's Gate syndrome. Bloated budget, director out of control, and so on. People are even calling it Warren's Gate. Now, I despised Heaven's Gate as much as the next guy, but that at least was an ambitious movie, an attempt to realize a rich and difficult personal vision. Ishtar's just the opposite. It's the apotheosis of the studio movie. And even though it's the vision of Elaine May, Dustin Hoffman, and Warren Beatty, it all looks planned by some faceless committee and compromised to reach every American wallet that might conceivably cough up $5. One hears that Hoffman and Beatty, who are usually rather difficult to work with, were pussycats on Ishtar. Is that because this movie never had anything worth fighting for in it? It's as though the filmmakers had forced themselves to think like a Hollywood studio in the middle of a story conference, as though they'd been tossing troublesome original ideas into the circular file and replacing them with CIA plots and gun battles and all the rest. All these talented people bending over backwards to make themselves mediocre, it's not a pretty sight. Sitting through Ishtar is almost painless. Thinking about it will make your blood boil.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
I met her and I fell.
No, cut out and I.
Oh, you want this one? I met her, fell.
Yes.
I loved her well.
Yes.
She walked out hell.
Yes.
Oh, heartbreak.
That's it. Do it again.
Do you need something stronger? I met her when.
Yes. I met her.
I met her. Bam. I loved it.
Let me try.
Software. I'm looking for software. I gotta have software for my machine.
I got it.
If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band. Hello.
Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with John Guare. His Broadway play, The House of Blue Leaves, will be featured on the next edition of the public television series American Playhouse. Performer Ian Whitcomb will recall the Tin Pan Alley era, and Ken Tucker will review movies just released on home video. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.